while she was doing brilliantly. While Catherine took a quick drink of water, her lawyer now introduced into evidence the deceitful full-page advert that Radium Dial had printed in the local paper. "Objection," Majid was reported to say, rising, but George Marvel allowed it to stand. After those New Jersey people died from radium poisoning in 1928, Catherine continued, "we began to get alarmed. But shortly after that, Mr. Reed called our attention to this advertisement. He said we did not have to worry." Marvel nodded slowly, taking notes and reviewing every word of the controversial notice. Catherine kept on with her testimony, looking over her shoulder at her friends, who sat in a row listening intently to her speak. "After Miss Marie Rossiter and I had been examined the first time," she recalled, turning back to face the judge, "we wanted to know why we didn't get our reports. Mr. Reed said to us, 'My dear girls, if we ever give a medical report to you, there will be a riot in this place.' Neither of us then realized what he meant. But they did now. As Catherine described the encounter in court, Marie paled at her words. 'Oh!' she cried aloud, the implication of her manager's words sinking in. 'That is the Mr. Reed,' Catherine added pointedly to the judge, 'who is still with the company in New York.' The papers had found him there, overseeing the dial-painting girls. He had assumed responsibility for the operation, which could well have been a promotion, since the New York plant was far more prestigious than the one in Ottawa. The company, it seemed, rewarded loyalty from its employees. There was a disturbance then, as the chief security examiner of the commission came rushing into the room, bringing documents that Grossman had subpoenaed. The lawyer quickly flicked through the files. He could see at once that the girls' test results from 1925 and 1928 were not included. There were, however, some letters of especial interest. Kelly, the president of Radium Dial, had written to the Illinois Industrial Commission in 1928. "We have not been successful in obtaining compensation insurance since the cancellation of our policy on August 18, 1928. In view of the publicity given the so-called radium poisoning cases of the United States Radium Corporation of New York, the insurance company decided they did not care to carry the insurance any longer and incur the risk of our having such cases at our plant in Ottawa, Illinois." Kelly had applied to 10 different insurance firms. All had turned him down. "You can readily see," Kelly continued, "that it makes it rather an unfortunate situation for us. Can you advise us how we may obtain protection? Does the state of Illinois have any compensation insurance?" Kelly's only thought was how he could protect the financial assets of his company. He didn't seem to consider that perhaps the insurance companies were refusing to cover him because what he was doing was too dangerous to support. In response, the commission told him, "The only thing you can do is to carry your own risk." Kelly had decided it was worth a punt. That was why there were no insurance company lawyers at this trial, because Radium Dial had no insurers. On October 30th, 1930, the IIC gave notice to Radium Dial that it had not complied with the Workmen's Compensation Act, which required insurance. In response, Radium Dial was forced to post securities and offer guarantees with the Industrial Commission that it was carrying its own risk. and this is when Radium Dial paid to the commission the $10,000 that Catherine and her friends were now trying to share between them. This was how that meager pot of money came to be. And there was no more money. Grossman had had no luck in tracing Radium Dial assets for the girls to claim from. Now that the firm had fled to New York, it seems the Illinois Industrial Commission had no power to reach across state lines to commandeer any of the company's funds. It was financially disappointing, but in many ways, this case was not about the money. It would make a difference, sure. Tom and Catherine in particular would be saved from destitution if they won, but it was more important to the women by far that what had happened to them be recognized. The girls had been shunned, told they were liars and cheats and frauds. They had seen the company literally get away with murder. The truth was what they were fighting for. To the almost continuous objections of Arthur Magid, which were all overruled, Catherine now told of her and Charlotte's visit to Mr. Reed after they'd been diagnosed. "Mr. Reed said he didn't think anything was wrong with us," Catherine whispered, as angrily as her weakened voice would allow. "He refused to consider our request for compensation." Marvel nodded, transfixed by Catherine. Her emaciated body was shaking, but she didn't let it stop her. "After 2 years," she said, remembering back to 1924, "I began to feel pains in my left ankle, which spread up to my hip. Fainting spells also occurred. At night the pain became unbearable." She told of how her pains had spread all across her body, her ankles, her hips, her knees, her teeth, how she had become a bedridden invalid, unable to eat, unable to care for her own children. And then, as her fingers twisted a scapular medal, a Catholic talisman, she told of no longer being able to kneel to pray. With immense pathos, she described her suffering, and not just her own. Catherine told the court how her two children were also affected. Shortly before her testimony ended, Catherine reached for her purse and withdrew a small jewelry box, which she held discreetly on her lap. She and Grossman had discussed this beforehand, so he asked her about the exhibit she had brought. Catherine bent her head to the box and lifted it up with her thin hands. The court leaned in, wanting to know what was inside. Slowly, very slowly, she opened it. And then, from within it, she withdrew two fragments of bone. "These are pieces of my jawbone," she said, simply. "They were removed from my jaw." 51. Catherine's friends, watching her hold up the pieces of herself, shuddered in the courtroom. Her bones were admitted into evidence, along with several of her teeth. After such staggering testimony, Grossman now allowed her to rest. She sat quietly in her chair, dabbing her handkerchief to her mouth, and watching as Dr. Walter Delitzsch came to the table to give evidence on her behalf. He was a clean-featured man, with a strong forehead, thick lips, and dark hair. He gave evidence authoritatively. Grossman took him through his dental treatment of Catherine, and then they proceeded to a more general discussion of radium poisoning. When Magid objected to Delitzsch's assertion that many dial painters became sick and died with diagnosis different to the truth, Marvel overruled him. The judge added emphatically, "The doctor is skilled and testified as an expert." It seemed the arbitrator was on Dalich's side. Dalich gave his expert opinion on the cause of Catherine's disease. "The condition," he said plainly, "is a poison from radioactive substances." With the killer statement in the bag, Grossman began more quick-fire questioning. "In your opinion," he asked, "is Catherine Donahue today able to do manual labor?" The dentist looked across the table at Catherine, who was huddled in her chair, listening to him speak. "No," he said sadly, "she is not." "Is she able to earn a livelihood?" "No," said Dalich, refocusing on Grossman. "Have you an opinion as to whether this condition is permanent or temporary?" "Permanent," he answered swiftly. Catherine dropped her head. "This is forever." "Have you an opinion," Grossman asked now, "if this is fatal?" Dalich hesitated and glanced meaningfully toward Catherine, who was only meters from him. Grossman's question hung in the air, suspended in time. 5 days ago, after the examinations in Chicago, Catherine's three doctors had indeed determined that her condition had reached its permanent, incurable, and terminal stage. Yet the physicians, who in all kindness sought to spare her, had not told Catherine Donahue. "In her presence?" Dalich now asked uncertainly. But he had said enough. He had said enough in the way he had paused. Catherine, sobbed, slipped down in her chair and covered her face with her hands. At first, silent tears ran down her cheeks, but then, as though the full weight of what he hadn't said hit her, she screamed in hysteria. She screamed aloud, as she thought of leaving Tom and her children, as she thought of leaving this life, as she thought of what was coming in her future. She hadn't known. She had had hope. She had had faith. Catherine had truly believed she was not going to die. But Dalich's face said otherwise. She could see it in his eyes. So she screamed, and the broken voice which had struggled to speak was now made powerful in her fear and distress. Tom broke down and sobbed at the sound of his wife's cries. The scream was a watershed. After it, Catherine could not keep herself upright. She collapsed and would have fallen had not a physician nearby caught her. Dr. Weena had leaped to his feet to hold her up, and as he did so, Tom seemed released from his paralysis. He rushed to Catherine's side as she lay slumped in her chair. While Weena felt for her pulse, Tom's concern was only for Catherine. He cradled her head with his hand, touched her shoulder to try to bring her back to herself, back to him. Catherine was sobbing hard, her mouth wide open, showing the destruction inside, the gaps where her teeth should have been. But she didn't care who saw. All she could see was Dalich's face in her mind. Fatal. This is fatal. It was the first time she'd been told. Pearl, seeing her friend so distraught, was just a moment behind Tom. The two of them bent over Catherine, Pearl proffering a cup of water that was not acknowledged. Tom had his arms around Catherine, trying to get through to her as she cried. His laborer's hand supported her, one on her back, another pressed to her front, trying to show her he was there. The press photographers wasted no time in capturing the moment. Tom was suddenly aware of them, suddenly aware that he wanted to get his wife away from all this. Leaving Pearl to care for Catherine, she gently stroked her friend's dark hair. Tom summoned Grossman and Weena, and together the three men lifted Catherine's chair and carried her from the courtroom. Pearl clearing the way through the people. The woman's sobs, a paper commented bleakly, could be heard from the corridor. As the judge called an immediate recess, Catherine was carried to the county clerk's office and laid out on a desk. Pearl spread Catherine's fur coat beneath her, so she had something soft and pleasant against her skin. Books of birth records propped up her head as a makeshift pillow. Tom gently eased his wife's glasses from her face and stood by her side. He had both hands on her, one holding her hand, which wore his watch, and the other softly caressing her hair to calm her. Pearl held Catherine's other hand, trying to reassure her friend. They both murmured soothingly to the woman they both loved. Catherine, by now, was too weak for tears, but as she felt her husband standing near her, she did have one thing to say. In a feebly wavering voice, she clutched his hand and murmured, "Don't leave me, Tom." He wasn't going anywhere. Catherine was unable to return to the hearing. "She is in total collapse," said an attending doctor. "She will not, cannot live very much longer." Tom was not there to hear his words. He had carried Catherine home to East Superior Street. Yet when the papers printed the pictures of Tom and Catherine the next day, they pulled no punches. Above a photograph of the stricken couple was the headline, "Death is the third person here." The hearing resumed at 1:30 p.m. in Catherine's absence. Having settled his wife at home, Tom had made his way back to the courthouse, wanting to represent Catherine at this hearing that was so very important to her. If she was not well enough to be there, then he would stand for her instead. The hearing picked up where it had left off, as Tom sat numbly in a chair at the back of the room. "Is her condition fatal?" asked Grossman of Dalich. The doctor cleared his throat. "It is fatal in her case," he acknowledged. "In your judgment," asked the lawyer, "what might be Catherine Donahue's reasonable life expectancy?" "I don't think we can state definitely," Dalich began to bluster, perhaps conscious of her husband sitting in court, "depending on the care she had and so on, treatment." Grossman fixed him with a look. This was a courtroom, not a clinic, and it did not help Catherine's case to beat around the bush. Dalich straightened up under Grossman's glare. "I would say months," he stated bluntly. Tom felt tears at his eyes again. Months. "There is no cure in its advanced stages?" queried Grossman. "No," said Dalich, "there is none." As the afternoon wore on, the other doctors were questioned. With each new testimony, the words became a litany of loss that Catherine's husband was forced to hear. "She is beyond a doubt in the terminal stages of the disease," testified Dr. Weena. "She has but a short time to live," concurred Loeffler. "There is absolutely no hope." No hope, no cure, no Catherine. Tom listened to it all with tears streaming down his cheeks. He endured it all. By the end of the afternoon, he was near collapse and had to be led from the courtroom. The company lawyer, for his part, made no showy gestures. He limited his cross-examinations of the doctors to what Radium Dial considered the critical issue. Was radium a poison? It seemed irrelevant to Majid that Loeffler declared, "There is a definite causal relationship between her employment and the condition in which I found her." Majid instead declaimed that Radioactive substances may be abrasive, but not poisonous. The company's position, the slick attorney explained, is that the women cannot recover compensation under the new section of the law because that relates only to diseases incurred from poisons as a result of occupation. With the firm determining radium was not a poison, they held themselves not liable. Majid called radium poisoning a phrase that was merely a convenient method of describing the effect of radioactive substances upon the human body. It was a position he maintained even when Loeffler said angrily, "The radioactive compounds had a poisonous effect upon Catherine's system, and their effect was not merely what is ordinarily termed abrasive, but comes under the medical definition of poisons." It was not lost on Grossman that this was the same lawyer who only a few years before had maintained radium was a poison in the Inez Vallet case. Grossman dubbed Majid's attempt to twist the truth brilliant sophistry and attempted magic by a past master in the wizardry of language and poison. The women's lawyer added, "For evidence in support of respondents' theory that radium is not a poison, the record is as silent as the Sphinx of Egypt." No testimony was presented to back up the company's claim. In contrast, the women had plenty to say, and with Catherine having recovered a little from her collapse, she was determined to continue giving evidence. Yet her physicians pronounced her too ill to leave her bed, and said she was in a state of complete collapse that might prove immediately fatal to her were she forced to continue as a witness. But Catherine was adamant. At this point, Grossman suggested that the hearing be resumed tomorrow at her bedside. If she couldn't come to the courtroom, then Grossman would bring it to her. George Marvel, after considering the request, agreed. It fell to Grossman to inform the press. As he announced that a bedside hearing would be held the next day, he added a final comment that he knew would provoke the press into copious column inches. "That is," he said darkly as he surveyed the gathered media, "in case she is alive." 52. When Friday, February 11th, dawned, Catherine Donahue was still alive. The weather outside on East Superior Street was unsettled, but Catherine, despite her weakened condition, felt certain of what she had to do. "It's too late for me," she said bravely, "but maybe it will help some of the others. If I win this fight, my children will be safe, and my friends who worked with me and contracted the same disease will win, too." It had been agreed by Radium Dial that Catherine's would stand as a test case. If the court found for her, then all the other victims would find justice as well. It made it all the more important to her that she did not fall at this final hurdle. She had to fight on, come what may. Tom supported her decision to testify, but he was worried sick. "All this is too late for us," he echoed, "but Catherine wants to do all she can to help the others. Even if the excitement..." His voice broke off abruptly. He had heard what the doctors had said, that continuing as a witness could prove fatal. But Catherine was determined, and who was he to stand in her way? "We've had so little time together," he simply said, quietly. They had been married just 6 years. Tommy and Mary Jane, then aged 4 and 3, were at home. They played upstairs, as the mass of visitors was directed to the dining room, where Catherine lay on the blue sofa, pillows propping her up, and a white blanket covering her to the chin. One after another, the guests crowded into the room, some 30 people in all, lawyers, witnesses, reporters, and friends. Catherine barely had the strength to open her eyes to welcome them. She made a pathetic spectacle. Her friends greeted her with evident concern. They usually visited this place socially, but today was a very different occasion. The women sat on chairs lined up by the sofa. Charlotte Purcell, who had come down from Chicago, was closest to Catherine. She sat next to Pearl. Charlotte had declined rapidly of late, having lost a tooth only the week before. She sat huddled in a thick gray coat, its left sleeve hanging empty by her side. The lawyers drew up chairs at the round oak table and spread their papers across it. Grossman, Magid, and Marvel, with Grossman's secretary, Carol, taking notes. Conscious of his children upstairs, Tom hovered halfway between the dining room and the rest of the house, leaning disconsolately against the door jamb. The scene thus set. The hearing now began. Weak but determined, Catherine Donahue was ready to resume her story. As Grossman questioned his client, he knelt by her side so that she could hear him better. She answered him through closed eyes. Only occasionally would she open them, and even then she didn't really seem to see. "Show us," Grossman encouraged, "how you were taught to point the brush, as you described in testimony yesterday." He held out a child's paintbrush toward her, taken from Tommy's watercolor set. As Catherine reached out a skeletal hand from beneath her blanket to take the brush, Arthur Magid rose from where he was seated at the table. "Objection," he said. "We object to the use of the brush, as there is no proof it is the same type that is used in the plant." Marvel turned to Grossman. "Is there one you could get?" he asked. "Yes," replied Grossman somewhat tartly. "They are being used now at the Luminous Processes plant, which is using all the equipment of the Radium Dial Company and employs some of the company's girls. There's even an official there who was at the Radium Dial Company." "It was decided," wrote a reporter after witnessing this exchange, "that the brush could be used for the demonstration." Catherine took the delicate paintbrush proffered by her lawyer. She paused for a moment, feeling its barely there weight in her hand, the way her fingers curled familiarly around it. "Here's how it's done," she croaked, after a beat. Her voice sounded tired. "We dipped it in the radium compound mixture." Catherine dabbed the brush into an imaginary crucible and then, very slowly, bent her stiff arm back and raised the brush to her lips. "Then shaped it," she said with some emotion, "like this." She slipped the brush between her lips and twirled it. Lip, dip, paint. When she was finished, she held it up with a shaking hand, the bristles now tapered to a perfect point. Seeing it, a shudder ran through her trembling frame. Her friends and former colleagues watched her with their faces drawn with emotional intensity. The women were visibly affected by her demonstration and fought back tears. "I did this thousands and thousands of times," Catherine said dully. "That was the way we were told to do it." Tom watched his wife from the doorway, watched as she demonstrated how she had been killed. Though he had thought himself wrung out of tears, he wept quietly, unashamedly, as Catherine showed off the simple movement that had left her little more than a living corpse. Grossman cut through the chilling atmosphere in the room with a question. Did any official of Radium Dial ever tell you that the U.S. government had condemned the use of camel hair brushes in painting with radium compounds? Catherine looked shocked to hear it. No, she replied. The girls sitting behind her exchanged looks of anger. Objection, piped up Majid, almost speaking over Catherine. Sustained, responded Marvel. Grossman wasn't thrown off track. He had another query. Was there any notice posted arising from the dangers of radium dial painting with the hairbrushes? He asked. No, sir, Catherine replied surely. There was none. We even ate our lunches on the work tables near the luminous paint. Our superintendent, Reed, told us it was all right to eat there, but not to let the food spot the dials. All they told us, she was panting now with the effort of speaking, was to be careful not to get any grease spots on the dials. Grossman touched her gently on the shoulder. She was exhausted, he could tell. He carefully took her through the remaining key points, including the debacle of the glass pens and the way she had been fired for limping, and then he let her rest. He called Charlotte Purcell to take the oath. Objection! Called out Majid immediately. He didn't want the other girls to give evidence, citing the fact that this was Catherine's case alone. This is a test case, Your Honor. Grossman cut in smoothly, appealing to Marvel. I don't know that I will have these girls with me at any future time. His eyes scanned the row of young women sitting alongside Catherine's makeshift bed. Not all of them, he added pointedly. Marvel nodded. He allowed the women to be questioned, though the girls were not permitted to testify directly about their own conditions. As Charlotte stood up to give evidence, Pearl helped her to slip her gray coat from her shoulders. Underneath, she was wearing a green blouse with a fussy white collar. Its sleeve hung limply, revealing her amputated arm. She came to the table to take the oath. Then she, too, twirled the brush in her mouth, showing her missing teeth as she did so. She testified calmly, as the anxious eyes of her friends followed her evidence. One girl's eyes filled with tears as Charlotte talked. "Were you employed?" Grossman asked her. "At the Radium Dial Company when Catherine Donahue was employed there, in the same room?" "Yes, sir," said Charlotte. Her stronger speech was in direct contrast to the strained whisper that had been all Catherine could manage. "Did you have your left arm, then?" Charlotte swallowed hard. "Yes, sir." "How long were you employed there?" he asked. 13 months, she said, almost spitting out the words. He asked her about the confrontation she and Catherine had had with Mr. Reed. "Did you have your arm then?" "No, sir," she replied bluntly. "What did Mr. Reed say?" "Mr. Reed," said Charlotte, her eyes burning angrily, "said he didn't think there was any such thing as radium poisoning." She testified. The loss of her arm was due to the poisonous compound used. One by one, Grossman called the girls to give evidence, which they did, sitting alongside the lawyers at the Donahue's dining table. Marie Rossiter clenched and unclenched her fingers as she reported what had gone on. "Mr. Reed said radium would put rosy cheeks on us," she remembered in disgust. that it was good for us. Grossman asked each of them in turn if the painting demonstrations had been an accurate reenactment of the technique they'd been taught. Like a row of doppelgangers, each nodded her head. All the women testified on Catherine's behalf, Pearl Payne, the Glachinsky sisters, Olive Witt, and Helen Munk, too. As each woman stood up, literally and figuratively, for her friend, she was mirrored by Arthur Magid, who continually objected to their evidence. Tom Donahue spoke only briefly to confirm the calamitous amount of debt that he and Catherine were in due to her medical bills. Throughout it all, Catherine herself lay dumbly on the sofa, sometimes dozing to the lullaby of her friends' voices as they lilted around her. At last it came to an end. Across the 2 days, 14 witnesses had given evidence for Catherine. Now, Grossman rested his case, and everyone turned expectantly to Arthur Magid. But the company lawyer presented no evidence and called not a single witness. The firm was standing solely on its legal defense that radium was not poisonous. With no further evidence to hear, shortly after 1 o'clock p.m., Marvel formally closed the hearing. He would, he said, give his verdict in a month or so. Before then, both sides would have opportunity to submit complex, written legal briefs, which set out their arguments in full. There was just one final element to the proceedings, an opportunity that the gathered reporters would never have let pass them by. Before the throng of people departed from the Donahue home, the media requested a photo call. George Marvel and Arthur Magid both moved behind the sofa, as Grossman knelt beside Catherine. A cigar was already between his fingers, now the case was at rest. As the men came into her line of vision, Catherine stretched out a thin hand toward George Marvel. He took it, clutching her fingertips gently, shocked at her emaciated bones, at how delicate her hand was. Catherine, later, deemed him so sympathetic. It wasn't just the attorneys who were required in the shot. Catherine's friends, too, surrounded her once the lawyers moved away. Charlotte perched on the arm of the sofa at her feet, while the others stood behind. Pearl Payne was in the center, holding her hand. All the women were looking at Catherine. But Catherine was looking at Tom. He had come forward, now that the hearing was over, and seated himself by her side. As the camera clicked, the husband and wife had eyes only for each other. Suddenly, a reporter later wrote of seeing Tom and Catherine together, "I forgot her crumbled teeth, the shattered jaws. I forgot the tragic remnants that radium poisoning left of a once handsome woman. I saw briefly, instead, the soul that holds her husband's love, a love grown blind to the fragile shell of a woman that is all other people see." There was just one other photograph. Hearing the meeting was over, Tommy and Mary Jane came running into the room. Tom lifted them up, one in each arm, and sat them on the back of the sofa, so that Catherine could see her children. And now, for the first time all morning, she came alive again, reaching out to hold Tommy's hand with an animated expression on her face as she chatted to her boy and girl. Mary Jane had sweet bobbed hair with a ribbon in it, and wore a colored dress. Tommy was in a long white shirt. Both seemed somewhat overwhelmed at all the guests and the photographers, and shortly afterwards, Tom ushered everybody out. Grossman and the other girls went directly to a downtown hotel, where they conferred at length before Grossman left for Chicago. The women knew that whatever happened next, it would affect them all. Even that day at the hearing, Majid had confirmed once again that, whatever the judge's decision, the firm would abide by it in handling the other dial painter's claims. With the hullabaloo of the court all gone, Tom shut the door of 520 East Superior Street. Somehow, the house seemed even quieter than it had before the hearing. Now, all he and Catherine could do was wait. 53. Spring is in the air, chorused the Chicago Daily Times the weekend after the trial. The newspapers were full of Valentine's adverts for romantic gifts, bridge parties, and dances, but there was only one date that the dial painters of Ottawa were keeping, and that was with Catherine Donahue. They found her in good spirits when they called on her. When a reporter, tagging along, asked Catherine what slim thread binds her to life, she replied, "It's the Fighting Irish," with a fond glance at Tom. "I will live," she said determinedly. Doctors had said that she would never leave her bed alive, but she was not done fighting yet. Together, the women prayed for a cure, yet there was no horror among them of death itself. Each declared, said the Chicago Herald Examiner, that if the fates decree, she will face the next world with the realization that her sacrifice may have saved others. For the women, somewhat to their surprise, had become poster girls for workers' rights. Already, they had effected a significant change in the law that protected thousands of vulnerable employees and removed a loophole by which corporations could shirk their responsibilities. Inspired by what they had achieved, that same day, Pearl Payne wrote to Grossman with an idea. "Sensing your humanitarian zeal for helping those on the lower rungs of life's ladder, it has occurred to me, as well as the other participants in the radium dial suit, that you forged the beginning of a society whereby those, of which there must be thousands, could band together, secure legal aid, and, in general, use our organized presence to simplify, promote, and improve the laws relative to those who are maimed due to occupational hazards." Grossman thought it brilliant, and so, on Saturday, February 26, 1938, the Society had its first meeting. The founding members were Pearl Payne, Marie Rossiter, Charlotte Purcell, and Catherine Donahue. Three of the four went to Chicago to meet Grossman. Catherine, far too ill to travel, was represented by Tom. They called themselves, with an instinct for a media hook that possibly came from Grossman, the Society of the Living Dead. "The purpose of the Society," announced Grossman to the gathered press, "is to obtain better protection by legislation and otherwise for persons endangered by occupational diseases." The meeting coincided with the filing of Grossman's first legal brief to Marvel, which was probably deliberate. "He loved the press," said his son. As the camera bulbs flashed, Grossman gave the girls their own copy of the pale green brief, signing Pearl's with the slogan, "Inhumanity's Cause." The dense document was some 80,000 words in length, and it saw Grossman in full flow. "The circumstances call for the sharpest pen I can unsheathe. I ask simply that the laws protecting folds ever serve as a shield to protect, and not a sword to destroy, the human right of Catherine Donahue to compensation. Give Catherine only what is justly and rightly due her under the law of God and man, and you will give her the award we ask." The brief was filed in the late afternoon, just in time to catch the evening papers, and the press were all over it, Coverage of the case jostled for space on the front page with stories about the Nazis in Germany. And if it was a trial by media, the girls would have won hands down. The papers called Radium Dial criminally careless. The press asked Tom Donahue if there was any hope of a cure. He replied that Francis Perkins, the Secretary of Labor, had sent medical authorities to investigate. There'd been some hope that a calcium treatment might prolong Catherine's life, but her illness was too advanced for her to survive the process. The federal investigations Perkins had ordered into the women's poisoning, meanwhile, appeared to have come to nothing. The government, struck by a double-dip recession within the Great Depression, had other priorities. One politician admitted they were floundering about the economy. "We have pulled all the rabbits out of the hat, and there are no more rabbits," he said. It was cold comfort to Tom, who was still without a job. Although the calcium treatment was not possible, Catherine still refused to surrender. "I am hoping for a miracle," she said. "I pray for it. I want a claim to life, and to stave off the end for the sake of my husband and children." Catherine's own mom had died when she was 6. She knew what it was like to grow up without a mother, and she was determined her own children would not suffer the same fate. But for all Catherine's courageous talk, as the weeks passed and they all waited for the verdict, her health deteriorated rapidly. "Once that stage of the illness began," remembered her niece, Mary, "it was just like a spiral down, down, down. It wasn't a gradual thing. It was fast." It left Catherine utterly unable even to direct her children's care via the housekeeper. "She was so ill," said Mary. "I truly do not remember her interacting with the children. She wasn't able. You can't imagine. It had just sapped all the energy and everything out of her." All Catherine could do was lie weakly on her bed in the front room with the shades drawn. Her days were punctuated by the taking of her medicine and by the frequent rattle of the train tracks behind the house, the sound of carriages bearing people away on journeys that Catherine Donahue could never now undertake. The house had a smell of urine. Her entire world was that front room. She lay under a blanket, the tumor on her hip a malignant mountain rising beneath, with every bone in her body aching. She was in so much pain. "I just remember her moaning, moaning," remembered Mary quietly. "You knew that she was in pain, but she didn't have the energy to scream. Moaning was about the best she could do. I think she just didn't have the energy to cry or cry out. She'd just moan." "I can't describe," she went on, "how sad that house was. You felt the sadness when you came in there." As Catherine's illness worsened, some of her relatives considered her condition too horrific for her young nieces and nephews to see. "She was falling apart from the radium," recalled her niece, Agnes. "They didn't want us to see her. They said she looked so terrible." So although Agnes's parents would visit Catherine once a week, she always had to wait outside. One relative who became a frequent visitor was Tom's big sister, Margaret. She was a stocky, 51-year-old woman who was the boss of the family. "She was the only woman that I knew of that could drive," recalled her nephew, James. "She had an automobile called the Whippet." Another relative remarked, "She'd go take care of Catherine and take care of the kids. She did what a good sister-in-law would do." Father Griffin was another regular visitor, and Catherine welcomed the nuns from the convent, too, who brought her a relic of the true cross. "It is like having God in the house with me," she exclaimed in elation. She also took solace from an unexpected source, the public. With her story emblazoned across the newspapers, readers were horrified by it in a way that some of the women's neighbors had never been. Catherine received hundreds of lovely letters that came from coast to coast. People sent her trinkets and ideas for cures, money for flowers to brighten her sick room. Some simply wrote in the hope that, "My letter will cheer you a little. You have my sympathy and my greatest desire for a complete victory," read one. "And I know millions of people think the same." Her friends also lifted her spirits. Marie would spend an evening with her, sitting by the side of the wrought-iron bed. "Olive brought me a chicken all cooked up lovely," Catherine wrote to Pearl with pleasure. "She, like you, dear, are truly pals, and may God bless you both." By March, Catherine had cheered considerably. "I'm sitting up for a few minutes today," she wrote proudly to Pearl, "and, oh, how good it feels after so long in bed." Leonard Grossman had not seen his bed for a very, very long time, or so it seemed. Throughout February and March, there was a convoluted exchange of briefs as he and Majid dueled with pen swords in further book-length submissions to Marvel. "He worked around the clock for a week," said Grossman's son. "He had three or four secretaries in." This crack team of assistants took dictation as Grossman paced his office or sat in his big chair with a cigar and reeled off the brilliant oratory for which he was famous. "I have been busy day and night," Grossman later wrote to Pearl, "working on the radium case." On March 28, 1938, the final brief was filed. After consideration of this, Marvel would deliver his verdict. In it, Grossman denigrated the company's shameful, shifting defense and what he called the cesspools in respondents' alibis, and continued, "Language can coin no fitting words of odium with which to condemn the cool, calculating radium dial company. Workers were lulled into a false sense of security by dastardly and diabolical false and fraudulent misrepresentations. The company knew," he wrote, "the legal duties which it owed to its employees and murderously refused them. Its officials repeatedly lied to Catherine to induce her and other employees to remain quiescent and not aroused and not aware of her true condition. They had," he said, "betrayed her." He did not mince his words. "I cannot imagine a fiend fresh from the profoundest depths of perdition committing such an unnatural crime as the Radium Dial Company did. My God, is the radium industry utterly destitute of shame? Is the Radium Dial Company utterly dominated by a beast? It is an offense against morals and humanity," he concluded, "and, just incidentally, against the law." He wrote powerfully. The judge had declared that he would not make a final ruling until April 10th. Yet on Tuesday, April 5th, the telephone burred in Grossman's office. He was summoned to the headquarters of the IIC at 205 West Wacker Drive, just around the corner from the Metropolitan Building. The verdict was in. 54. There was no time to tell the Donahues. Grossman managed to summon those few former dial painters now living in Chicago, Charlotte Purcell and Helen Munk, and they alone were able to reach the hearing in time. It was held just before noon. Helen was nervously smoking a cigarette as they all crowded into the wood-paneled IIC room to hear the verdict. George Marvel's judgment was read aloud by the chairman of the commission. Both Majid and Grossman stood to hear him speak. The two attorneys sized each other up as the chairman called for silence. Mrs. Donahue, Marvel had written, was suffering from a disease that was slow, insidious in its nature, progressive, and extending over a long period of years. He concluded, "The disablement sustained made Mrs. Donahue incapable of following any gainful occupation." Those in the court shifted restlessly. They knew all this. The question was, would he find the company at fault? The written judgment proceeded. The Industrial Commission finds that a relation of employer and employee existed between the company and the plaintiff. Catherine Donahue's disability did arise out of and come in the course of her employment. He had found the company guilty. Charlotte and Helen could not help their reaction. They were jubilant. Helen stretched out a grateful hand to Grossman as he turned to them with an irrepressible grin. "I am very glad for Mrs. Donahue," Helen breathed. "It is a just decision." Marvel awarded Catherine her past medical expenses, back salary for the entire period she had not been able to find employment due to her condition, damages, and an annual life pension of $277, $4,656, for the remainder of her life. It came to a total of some $5,661, $95,160, and was the maximum possible award the judge could deliver under the provisions of the law. One suspects that he wished he could have gone further. Marvel was reported to have said after Catherine's collapse in the courthouse, "It would seem to me, from what has been disclosed here, that there could have been a common law action against these people. There is and has been a gross negligence on the part of the Radium Dial Company." The company officials were guilty. Guilty of causing Catherine's disablement, and Charlotte's, too. But not just that alone. They were guilty of killing Peg Looney, Ella Cruz, Inez Vallet, so many more. Those women's lives could not be saved, but their murderers were now unveiled in the cold light of day. "The whole creation of God," Grossman had written in his legal brief, "has neither nook nor corner where the Radium Dial Company can hide the secret of its guilt in this case and escape." The light of justice now flooded in, leaving the callous killers exposed for what they were. There was no full-page ad to hide behind here, no jolly superintendent smoothing down the girls' furrowed brows, no hidden test results that kept the truth concealed. The truth, after all these years, was finally out. "Justice has triumphed," declared Grossman exultantly at the hearing. "No other decision is possible under the overwhelming weight of evidence. A just award follows the rule of conscience. Thank God for justice to the living dead." Charlotte Purcell simply said, thankfully, "This is the first ray of hope we have had after years of discouragement." It had been a long, long battle. In many ways, it was a battle that had begun on February 5th, 1925, when Marguerite Carlo had first filed suit in New Jersey, the very first dial painter ever to fight back. Catherine's triumph in court 13 years later was one of the first cases in which an employer was made responsible for the health of its employees. What the girls had achieved was astonishing, a groundbreaking, law-changing, and life-saving accomplishment.